Conference Committee on the Data Practices Act omnibus bill will come to order. When we left off last night, it was a little unconventional for those of you who were here. We in the House were under call and had to go vote. I think that the Senate shortly thereafter ended the hearing. There was some talk of taking testimony, but I don't think that was done. Is that correct, Senator Olson?
That's correct, Representative Simon. I don't believe we heard any more after you left. We did stay for some discussion.
Well, where we were last night is we were discussing one of the flashpoints here, which is the Social Security legislation that's tucked into the bill, and I think we should just pick up where we left off. I think if I remember, Ms. Cook was going to testify, and then the House members had to leave. So why don't we just pick up where we left off, and Ms. Cook, if you want to go ahead and talk about the contours of the law in here and what you'd like to see.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee. My name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Gerard Associates, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. Appreciate the opportunity to visit with you about this when I'm a little more fresh this morning. At the outset, I just want to reiterate what Representative Hillstrom said about the many, many hours and long discussions that we have had on this issue. And I also might add that I've been working closely with the Fair Information Practices Coalition, which is really when Representative Hillstrom referenced the 50-plus people who were involved. It is a broad, broad cross-section of the business community, healthcare community, and others who share concerns about helping us to find this balance between protecting personal information of consumers and making sure that we are able to use the Social Security number for legitimate and serious real purposes in commerce. And what I'd like to do this morning is provide some context for the language on Social Security numbers that's in the House bill, which we support and encourage you to adopt. I know there's a couple little tweaks that some folks may want to that were in discussions when the bill came up on the House floor. But generally, I hope you understand that this is a compromise position that has a lot of additional protections for consumers with respect to things like internet, use of Social Security numbers, when a business can refuse to do business with someone if they won't give you a Social Security number, tightening up the mailing of Social Security numbers and whether or not it's visible on the outside of an envelope. I mean, there are additional protections, and then along with that, the understanding that we need some clarifications in the statute that, A, allow us to address this, the issue that Mr. Tennyson raised, and I'll talk a little bit about that, and also make it clear that for businesses who need to use Social Security numbers, they are able to continue to do so. Just in terms of context, the Social Security law that's on the books was first passed in 2005. I believe it was introduced in 2004. It was amended last year in a bill carried by Representative Holberg and Senator Betzel by request, I believe. And back in 2005, it was made effective on 7/1/07. So they did have a delayed effective date in order to allow businesses to be able to prepare for the changes that were necessary in the statute. Last year, I believe it was in the Senate Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and it was on the House floor. And then when the data practice bill was put together, quite at the end of session, that language was included. I think it's important for you to know that we currently do have the most restrictive law in the nation on Social Security use right now. This takes it a step further. And frankly, from the business community's perspective, I know some of you have said, well, what would happen if we do nothing? I think our overall preference at the start of session was no more changes this year. Let's see how, when this law goes into effect on July 1st, what happens. And Representative Hillstrom introduced House File 131, which probably the first week of session, and we got to work on this in earnest. Really have worked nonstop since. There were a number of discussions, obviously, in the committees in the House, but much of the real work on the language among the stakeholders, many, many hours, was done, frankly, outside of the committee process as we worked to try and craft language that, as I said, would find the right balance. And that was really the objective, finding the proper balance between consumer protection of personal information and providing for legitimate business use of Social Security numbers. I want to remind everybody it is the only unique identifier out there right now, and it's important to the flow of many commercial transactions today And I won't go into the details because I think you're all aware of it. But it is also a very important tool for businesses to prevent identity theft. And the FTC just a few weeks ago actually gave testimony in Congress and talked about the need for balance in terms of restrictions on Social Security numbers and said that being too restrictive can actually be deleterious. The language in the House bill, I think, acknowledges the necessary balance. And I think the issue that's really sort of requiring some action right now, we hope, from you is this issue that's come up with respect to the credit bureaus. My recollection is that issue, and maybe Representative Holberg can correct me if I'm wrong, is that the credit bureaus did not really raise the issue with this Section 7, which talks about the sale of Social Security numbers, until after this had been passed into law last year. And as the Bankers Association and others in the business community worked with Representative Holberg, Senator Betzold, and others who were working on this, we had been assured that this language would not affect the sale of things such as, for example, a mortgage on the secondary market, where the Social Security number was part of the paperwork but incidental to the transaction. And I think that most people maintain that interpretation. But nonetheless, the credit bureaus have determined that that is not their interpretation, and this would prevent them from providing credit reports with full Social Security numbers. And in mid-April, they actually began informing businesses, banks, others, that they are revising their systems to not provide full Social Security numbers. And so what happens if you decide to wait until next year? Well, businesses and Minnesota consumers really can't wait to see what happens on July 1st. I know some people have said, well, you know, call their bluff. Well, the reality is we can't wait because millions will have to be spent. I mean, literally, we're hearing millions by major companies who get credit reports to adjust their systems to accept truncated credit reports that have truncated or no Social Security numbers for Minnesota. And if the credit bureaus do stop credit reports with full Social Security numbers, it will make, for example, for financial institutions, our job in identifying people much more difficult. It will result in slower transactions, and frankly, our fear is that it could result in more identity theft because we won't have the complete Social Security number to make sure that the person sitting across us is who they say they are. And so while I know there's general concern between the Senate, which did not hear this issue, and the House, I'm really, and I tend not to be a sky is falling person because I understand how, you know, you all view those threats. The issue is it's not a threat coming from us. It's coming from someone else being thrust upon my client and others in the business community. And as I said, we can't wait to see what happens on July 1st. And so really urging you to address this issue this year. As I said, we've worked hard on the language in the House bill. I know Senator Olson did ask for language that would just address that specific issue, which I know you have in the form of an amendment. And But I did want you to know that a lot of effort went into the House language, and we feel it does provide a good balance.
Just before I call on Senator Olson, just a quick roadmap. I want to call on Senator Olson and have her speak, but I know we have a couple people, in particular Mr. Neumeister, who has an appointment at 9:45 and has expressed a strong preference to testify before then. Senator Olson.
Can I, Representative, I appreciate it if I can just say this much. I have no idea what the roadmap would be in terms of the history of this issue because I wasn't here last year. Even talking about this last year, because we weren't part of these hearings and didn't start at the beginning where someone would give us that history and then go through and walk us through the bill and explain the changes and compare it to where things were at and then give us a chance to talk about it. Now, at this stage, all we're being told is this is why we need it, but it's totally without any context. And so that being said, without that context and that explanation, we can't even judge for ourselves what you're saying, whether we think it's concern, you know, something that's legitimate or not, or should be done this way or should be done a different way. And if we don't have that context, we can't possibly make that determination. We looked at the amendment last night among ourselves after other people had left, and it still seems to us that it goes way beyond the scope of just addressing that one very narrow thing. So I just want to say that to explain to you kind of our frustration as we go forward. And if you can give us some more of that background after Mr. Neumeister's not here, maybe that would help.
Madam Chair, and Senator Olson, that would be great. I do think it would be helpful to hear from Mr. Neumeister. And also, Joe Witt from the Minnesota Bankers Association is here. I'm more the generalist in sort of the process, how we got here person. And Joe obviously can speak about some of the details if you have questions. And, Senator Olson, I'm sorry that it didn't work out for the Senate. And as I said, under normal circumstances, I think the business community would be quite satisfied to just let the law that's on the books go into effect on July 1st, see how it works, and come back and work on it. And I do think this is not an issue that this will be the last we see of it. But the House language does go beyond this particular issue, because it was about working in the framework of what Representative Hillstrom and others sought to do, and finding that balance, which we really felt like we did. So I acknowledge that it does go beyond that one specific issue.
Representative Hill. Thank you, Madam Chair. I kind of feel like my bill was a bit hijacked. My goal was to do something much more restrictive, and I ended up having to deal with this issue because they convinced me that their issue was equally important. So while that was never my intent to fix number 7, ever, I needed to come to the table and compromise as well, because my bill was the vehicle to take care of their issue. So I agreed to do that as long as I didn't lose the intent of my original bill as well.
I think we're going to thank you, Representative Hilton. We're going to revisit that thread. But first, I did promise Mr. Neumeister, because we have an appointment at 9:45. He's waited patiently. He'd like to wait.
Mr. Chair, and just for, to try and help me get to starting point here, that we have 2 documents, and I'm not sure who distributed them or they both are talking points on amendments and both on the Social Security number issue, but I don't see a copy of any particular amendment that I think the Senate referenced that they had discussed an amendment, and I don't know who distributed these and from what source they came.
Thank you. Representative Oberg, I just was told that these came from Mr. Tennyson, that they were distributed last night after we had left, we in the House had left, because we were under call.
Okay.
So these come from Mr. Tennyson.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Neumeister, do you want to just introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Rich Neumeister, and members of the Conference Committee, thank you very much. I'm taking my lunch break from work at this point, so I appreciate it. First of all, if you could please pass these out to the Conference Committee members, please. Mr. Chairman, members of the Conference Committee, everybody wants it. They want the SSN. Your bank, your health club, your utility company. Sometimes even the guy at the video store wants it. Also in the testimony in the House, in the other body, Mr. DeLaForest gave an example of where a situation, and maybe some of the House members can talk about that, where they were interested in getting a Social Security number for some activity. The other thing that's important to know is that the Social Security number is used in many ways to link databases, to gain information about you in all kinds of situations. This bill, which was basically, from my understanding, an initiative of the Attorney General's office, was introduced by Ms. Hillstrom and Mr. Chandray. Now, with Ms. Hillstrom and the Attorney General, primarily through the Attorney General representatives, I have offered suggestions to improve on this bill. And when we talk about stakeholders have been primarily business community. Generally, on these kinds of issues, you're not going to have a lot of consumer groups lobbying, because in Minnesota there's not a lot of consumer groups. So one of the things that I've always done in my nearly 30 years here now, next year, is try to enunciate those things for policymakers. Now, the current proposal on the House side, I think, have basically 5 problems. 1, it will open up more proliferation of identity theft. We know that ID theft is an increasing epidemic. Secondly, When you have on part of the bill, which I'll go into a little bit, where people are going to start asking more for your Social Security numbers, I can see where there can – for authentication and whatever with businesses, I can see where that ID problems could happen. Secondly, loss of privacy. Third, the language as proposed calls basically coercive disclosure of your Social Security number. It legitimizes where, by use of government law, where Social Security number is obligated to be given in a private sector business transaction. And if you don't do that, you could be refused the service. Four, it's contrary to the spirit of the federal law of the 1974 Privacy Act and various amendments since then. And in a way, I contend that the businesses could possibly discriminate in that regards. Now, to get into the specific parts of the bill and then my suggestions, I think it's on R29. R28 it begins. First of all, what I've handed out to you is basically the exemptions. When you look at in the language now that you'll be looking at where it says 1681B of the Fair Credit Reporting Act, where it says under fine law, those are the exemptions basically of that. I wasn't able to get a copy of the Graham Bleach Bliley. Secondly, you have a general premise of what federal law is now in regards to how Social Security numbers can be used in as it relates to government. So if we just go to R28, one of the things that we talk about is the Social Security number on the internet. And if you take a look at this handout that I gave you here, where it says what you should know when a government entity wants to collect your Social Security number. On the bottom here, it talks about how there has to be like a notification, which goes to those fair information principles that I have always lobbied for, which might be different than what business may do. And so government should be doing this. And if the private sector is going to be doing that, if you're going to adopt this House language, I suggest that there be a notice provision sort of tailored on what the federal does for the private business. If you go on page R29 and you go to where my heart of the matter is line 30, 32, where it's basically legitimizes where if you refuse to do business with the individual because the individual will not consent to the disclosure of or provide the individual's Social Security number unless in connection with the transaction. They are like two Mack trucks. On one hand, yes, we're going to protect your privacy, but then on the other hand, with these broad exemptions, you're giving a Social Security number now to a lot of number businesses where you're now starting to say that in law. Now, if you look on the 1681 and if you look at the list that I provided of the exemptions, you can see how broad these exemptions are, particularly on page 2 under F, where otherwise has a legitimate business need for the information in connection with the business transaction that is initiated by the consumer. Basically, it's like for almost any business transaction, they can ask you for a Social Security number. And if you refuse to do it, if you look further on down, it says then we don't have to basically do business with you. The other thing that I have a concern about is the issue about reasonable basis, that the individual is using a false identity or document. The other issue is where the person or entity is expressly required or authorized. This is on 314.315. Now, granted, this is not where the government is asking you for directly for your Social Security number. This is where maybe some county law or ordinance or whatever will say that a private entity can ask you for your Social Security number for whatever purpose. Again, it goes contrary to what the federal government has basically always outlined what Social Security numbers are for, in basically four broad areas: child support, tax purposes, welfare reform, and I think there's another one there, too. I don't know for sure, but that's at least from my memory on there. Now, the other thing that if you go on to page R30, and this was something that came in as an amendment, it was not in the original bill, is where on 3134 and 3135, it talks about where, now this is one of the things, and this is what's happening, Social Security numbers may be sold to different companies or where entities want to be able to get these Social Security numbers from the companies that sell them. One of the concerns I have is government, when you talk about law enforcement, government, or for public safety purposes, are getting the Social Security number through a backdoor way where they're not asking you directly for it, which basically the federal law does say if it's mandatory or voluntary, and within for mandatory for only those four purposes. That's a concern I have. And also on 32.3 where it talks about health. In summary, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there are different routes you can do. If you're going to go the route of the House bill and just take the House bill as is, I would suggest two provisions, or at least several, a couple. One is that there be a notice. Very clear that if you're going to adopt number 9, to refuse to do business with an individual because the individual will not consent, that what you do is that there has to be a notice provision in there to basically tell reason why, how come, what it's going to be used for, and it has to be secured, that it will be secured. Now, Illinois has tried to do this kind of thing in that regards. Those are suggestions that I have given to the Attorney General, who is working with Ms. Hillstrom. Again, I guess those were discussed, but the business community basically said, no, we don't. That's at least from my understanding. There are also a suggestion of Rhode Island, which is very, very narrow, very clear, where it says that unless otherwise required by federal law, no person shall require that a consumer of goods or services disclose a Social Security number incident to the sale of consumer goods or services, provided, however, that insurance companies and institutions licensed by state or federal government for financial services, which tie into that federal authorization why there should be Social Security numbers, may require applicants for those services to disclose their Social Security number, or disclosure may be required of a consumer as a condition of applying for a credit card for the purchase of goods or services. They also have some penalties and some things which is different than what is in the proposed bill of 831. And also, if you provide a notice provision, you know, I can see where there's some halfway there. I do have some concerns, though, where we're saying we're protecting privacy, but we're now going to put in a big thing where you can ask people for their Social Security number in all kinds of businesses, and if they refuse it, then you can deny that service. Mr. Chairman, members of the conference committee, those are my points.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Unless anyone else, member on the committee, wants to comment on that or anything else, we'll go to some of the other testifiers. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neumeister, I know that you spoke to me at one point about something else that is on a different subject, but as long as you have to leave, if there's something you'd like to turn to, it had to do with how we're defining public, whether it's going to apply to all government agencies or local as well.
It's basically the grant language. I would encourage to put state agency. I mean, that's one that has been one involved with the State Department's bill. They did that, and it's...
You don't happen to know what section that is?
I think it's section 43, and I spoke with Chairman Simons about that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much for a few moments of your time.
Thank you. Members, I'd like to resume with some of the testimony from other stakeholders on this issue. Ms. Cook alluded to it earlier, and I don't know if she wants to come up or if there's someone else you'd like to speak to.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. While they're coming up, I just wanted to comment that while the business community is represented here, I did have the endorsement of AARP on the Social Security bill prior to the amendment that we put on the floor which was the tweaking of 7 for the business community. So so I don't think anyone is there from here from there, but they did weigh in on this bill as well.
Ms. Cook, do you want to do any introducing, or should we just go ahead?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee. My name is Joe Witt. I'm President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you a little bit about this very important subject here today. I'd like to just start by saying a couple of comments with respect to Mr. Neumeister's testimony. He started out by saying everybody wants the Social Security number. Everybody wants it. But I don't think that's what we're here to talk about today. I think that sort of fortuitous wanting of the Social Security number has already been worked out by the law that's on the books, as well as through the amendments that you're looking at here today. We're not talking about people requesting a Social Security number simply because they want it. Banks, insurance companies, brokerage houses request Social Security numbers because federal law requires them to do that. And in addition to requiring us to collect that information, there are very detailed federal laws and regulations that require us to safeguard that information once we have it. Mr. Neumeister also made a statement that that this collection of Social Security numbers is going to open up more identity theft, and I disagree with his conclusion on that as well. I think the issues that we're talking about here today, the legitimate uses of Social Security numbers and the legitimate safeguarding of that information is not the threat that he made it out to be. He also referenced the legitimate refusal to do business section that's in the bill that you guys are looking at. And again, I'd like to just remind you that when federal law requires a bank or an insurance company or a brokerage house to collect that information, and the person refuses to give us that information, we are left in obviously a very tough spot, and that's why we worked hard for that legitimate refusal to do business provision. The federal law that requires us to collect it is part of the USA Patriot Act. I think we've had discussions about that in the past. As you all remember, after 9/11, Congress passed tougher laws on anti-terrorist financing. In the banking world, those ended up as being amendments to the Bank Secrecy Act, which was originally put in place for banks to help the federal government detect tax evasion. At the time that was put on the books, the banks and other businesses became a little bit like an arm of the federal government in that we were required to police our customers. And the anti-terrorism rules under the USA Patriot Act were an extension of that. I can tell you from the banking community, we didn't want that responsibility. We didn't want the responsibility of helping prevent tax evasion. We didn't necessarily want the responsibility of anti-terrorist actions under the USA Patriot Act, but it's something that federal law requires us to do. We are required to affirmatively identify our customers, and part of that is that we are required by federal regulations to collect those Social Security numbers. So again, when we're talking about these situations, it isn't the fortuitous use of Social Security numbers that impacts us. It's that we are required by law to collect it. And then I remind you again that we do have those requirements as well to safeguard that data and protect it, whether it's in an electronic form or a paper form. I'd be happy to stand for any questions that you have or answer anything with respect to my testimony.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Once again, I just want to reiterate my concern. I heard a little bit of background about this from one witness about the fact that there was a date issue that had something to do with a bill that was heard a year or two ago that apparently Senator Betzel carried by request. But this, if we were hearing this in committee, someone would begin by laying out the bill to us and telling us what it does and telling us what the history of this is and telling us how Social Security numbers are traditionally handled. And then we'd go on to talk about what changes in the law this makes in comparison to the law that we've had traditionally and the purposes that we've tried to accomplish over the last couple of years with Social Security numbers. And we would be clearly given an opportunity to look at each one of these provisions and to have those discussions. And none of that is happening here. All we're kind of hearing is why you think this needs to be done with really no explanation. And it seems much broader. Just because a few people in this room, Mr. Chair, are here to talk about what relates to their specific concern that has to do with this, and those may be very legitimate concerns, we need to look at the whole language and what it says and what it does and who else might be affected by this as well. The concern that Mr. Neumeister raised that has to do with refusal to do business, for example, we have people here from the banking community. Does this only relate to banking business? Mr. Chair, I see the witnesses are saying no, and that's kind of what I'm assuming. So even though that might be the witness's concern, obviously this has broader ramifications that we're not having an opportunity to hear about or discuss in this kind of context. And that's our whole problem with trying to do this without the benefit of taking this type of legislation through hearing so we can really understand the whole context of it.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might not get every element of this right, but in general terms, the background of this, and it's pretty much a perennial issue that there's always somebody who wants to totally lock down use of Social Security number. They come and go around here, whether they be in the executive branch or as legislators. And so you get these efforts to, we're just not going to, you know, use Social Security for anything. It's going to protect privacy. And then you study a little bit, you get the 19 exceptions, the federal law with the 19 exceptions, and you start looking at it. And I don't know if 2 years ago if it was the administration's initiative. I think 2 years ago the administration was going to turn Chapter 13 on its head and make everything that was public private and everything that was private public. And I don't remember if the Social Security part was part of that or whatever, but somebody brought me a bill that was, you know, had they wanted to just lock down the use of the Social Security number. Well, it's hard to do that given the federal requirements, and the state can, tinker around the edges. And I think we did what we thought we could, but given that the issue was complex, put the effective date off to allow time for people to take another look at it. And so that's why the effective date was pushed off. And then I was aware that Representative Hillstrom had another bill that was introduced, and so I haven't been very active this year in this process, and maybe I should have been, given that that one portion of it was a fix from the 05 legislation. But quite frankly, sometimes you just kind of tire of of issues, and it appeared to me that Representative Hillstrom was working on it and working with the advocates and was spending the time with it, so... I admit to not being very involved in the process, but if, in fact, the current law that's going to go into effect is going to have this huge negative consequence and we're able to determine that, I think that it's something that we can discuss. And in legislation, we don't always have the benefit of being able to have everything fit into the committee process, and certainly I'm willing today and tomorrow to take whatever time it needs so that the members of the conference committee can get all the information in the background and consider what a reasonable solution would be.
I'm just going to put in a word here before I go to Senator Limmer, and I think this goes to a process point that came up yesterday. And while I certainly do understand, Senator Olson, your concern and the institutional concern of the Senate, anytime there's language in the House Senate bill, and it could go vice versa, although with this bill there isn't as much, I just have to say that in echoing what Representative Holberg said, I mean, this is the hand we've been dealt, and if the standard we're going to be setting here or in any other conference committee is that where there's House language, or where one body's language exists and not another's, and there was a file in each body that just wasn't acted on, that's out of bounds, I really fear some of the perverse incentives that's going to put into play. I mean, imagine Representative Hillstrom here if she knew that the position of the Senate would be, as long as it's not in the Senate bill, it's absolutely off the table and can never be adopted, why would she have wasted her time meeting with advocates over many weeks and months? And I would say the same thing about the Senate. If there were extra material in this bill from the Senate, not in the House, at some point, we in the House, I would hope, would sort of say, you know, a lot of smart people in the Senate worked on this, people we know and we like and we trust, and we're not going to agree on anything. We can't get up to speed in a day's time or maybe 2 days' time, but at some point, we're just going to have to defer and say, you know what, we didn't hear this in our chamber because maybe someone sat on their butt. You know, maybe an author, for whatever reason, didn't choose to move the bill. And I hope we're not establishing here a standard for this or any other conference committee where just because language exists in one body and not another, that we're going to punt on it. I mean, that's not the way things are done around here, and we would never have conference committees if that were the case. So I understand the process issue. And by the way, if the issue is that you don't like the policy, that's different, or you don't like what's in the House. But what I'm hearing is something else, which is that it's in the House, it's not in the Senate, and because the Senate didn't have a chance to hear testimony on it, more than what we've heard today, that it's somehow out of bounds. And I think that's it. That is inappropriate if what I'm hearing, in my opinion. The other thing I would say is we're doing now what would have happened, I would imagine, in a Senate committee. We're hearing testimony. We're hearing from Ms. Cook. We're hearing from the bankers. We're hearing from consumer advocates. We're hearing from others. So I don't know quite what extra would have been provided in a Senate hearing in the crush and press of legislative business. We just can't all make ourselves into experts. So the point I want to make is this, and I'm only a second termer, so I may be way out to lunch here, but this is what conference committees are all about. Sometimes one body has stuff in it that the other body just hasn't had the time or inclination to hear. And especially where there's a House file and a Senate file, as opposed to just a floor amendment or a committee amendment, it isn't the fault of one body that, given two files and two bodies, the author in the other body just didn't do his or her job for whatever reason. And the one body can't be punished for having gone through the process and having listened to it. So I want to make that very clear. If the standard we're setting here is that because something is in one body and not in another, we're just not going to consider it because it didn't go through a vetting or filtering process, that I think is inappropriate and really turns the concept of a conference committee on its head. Otherwise, we'd come in here, we'd have a 60-second conference committee, we'd move same or similar and say, bye and good luck. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that it has ever been the situation where a body would simply say, you know, if we didn't look at it because it's in the other one, we're never going to consider it. And I don't think that's the Senate's position on the Social Security issues. We've raised the point and the issues that this is a lot of language and we're not familiar with it. However, it is also absolutely not true that anybody can come into a conference meeting and say, this is what we've worked out, this is the way it's got to be, you're not changing anything, and accept it as it is. And last night, we heard the fact that everything that's in here is a package. You can't take one thing out or it's going to ruin the whole thing. That is also unacceptable. And, Mr. Chair, I think there's an easy way to resolve this issue, a very easy way to resolve this issue. If this House is interested in listening to it, I can tell you how we can resolve it very quickly.
Okay. What I'd like to do is take whatever more testimony there is on this issue, and then I think we can talk either on the record here or one-on-one or one-on-two about proposed solutions. But I think it's important to get testifiers who have waited yesterday and today to talk, and then let's talk about that language.
Representative Senator Olson. I'm also new at this, but just for the record and from what I've learned about this process, I would like to say that I think there's a big difference between something that comes up because in the brainstorming process of the committee, someone comes up with an idea or an amendment or for whatever reason, then as compared to a major policy issue that's been through numerous committees in the House that we would also want to take through those same numerous committees in the Senate, and then bring to the Senate for a vote of the members as to whether that should be part of the bill or not, with an opportunity for amendments and full discussion, as compared to something that only a very few of us are going to hear and talk about, and then bring it back in a conference committee report that goes up and down, or down on the floor.
There's a big difference there. And so it's certainly not true that in a conference committee it's going to be all up or down unless we have identical language. But a major policy issue that hasn't been through any committees without any of the opportunity for that input and discussion is very different. And that's what we feel we're seeing here. In addition to that, there were, it sounds like, perhaps for policy reasons, the author didn't like this policy. I don't know specifically the reasons. But if there was a Senate author who didn't like the policy, there was an ample opportunity perhaps to find another author or something like that. I can't speak for someone else. All I can say is those are our concerns. And there's a big difference between how this would be handled and what we have the opportunity to do here. The very first thing that someone starts out is walking us through a bill and presenting the bill. We're not getting any of that. We're getting the after the fact, this is why we have to do this, or this is why we shouldn't do this, without even the opportunity to really understand what it is that's being proposed. And that's a big difference.
Why don't we continue with testimony, and then we'll get back to some members' comments. I am particularly interested in hearing from Representative Hillstrom, and maybe Hillstrom, if you haven't already, you could provide sort of that bullet-pointed summary of what we've heard and where you think we ought to go, because you were the initial or original author of this provision. Why don't we continue with testimony? Was there any more from the testifiers at the front of the table? No.
Mr. Chair, I guess the only thing I'd like to point out is I guess maybe Representative Hillstrom can go through the different pieces. Balance, and there are numerous provisions that do provide protections to consumers. This is not all about a business community bill. It's about finding the right balance between additional protections for consumers to make sure that the Social Security numbers and the flow of commerce are being used for legitimate purposes. Finding that balance. And so if Representative Hillstrom will go through the details, I think we can be available should there be questions about specific provisions. But I really want to make that point that there are a lot of additional protections for consumers in this as well. Thank you.
We have at least two people who want to weigh in on this. Go ahead, just introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the conference committee, my name is Nancy Hilden. I am here. I've been asked to make a brief statement on behalf of Prudential, because the failure to act on the many, many hours of work that the House put into this actually has a very serious consequence for their company. If you look at page 30 on the side-by-side, I am here too, as I believe that the language that was put in will go into effect July 1st of this year, I think was designed to provide an exemption for what they do. They are an administrator of employee retirement and employment benefit plans. And if you look at subdivision 3, you'll see that in the House, there's language on lines 31.21 and 31.30. So the existing law, as it was passed, again with that same effective date of 2007, July 1, 2007, this summer, was designed to make an exemption for uses of Social Security numbers for internal verification. The problem that Prudential has, and I think that they were hopeful that they could find a way to read this, but they are very cautious in how they read this language, and as it applies to them, they believe that there is not an internal verification structure for using Social Security numbers to make sure when you transfer money for an employee into their retirement account or their benefit plan that they can actually use that. The consequence, and I've just gotten off the phone with them, the consequence is that they will have to go through prior to July 1, 2007, and come up with some alternative way to do an account identifier to validate those transfers. And they estimate the cost of that to be approximately $1 million. And so, ironically, while it was designed to try to address their legitimate, lawful, and valid and necessary use of Social Security numbers, they believe that the language in the current law, which we did have time this legislative session for that delayed effective date to go over, but the failure of the Senate right now to come up with working language, it puts them in the circumstance of having to implement something which really was designed to actually have an exemption in the law as it was passed before. With that, I'll answer questions or...
I have one or just a point of clarification. You and I have spoken away from this committee. My understanding is that your proposed fix, assuming just for a moment that we're working off of the House language, that's the only language before us currently, my understanding is you just want to add one word. You want to add the word investment.
Yeah. Yeah,
page R30.
We also do work for the Mutual Funds Association, the Investment Company Institute. And again, that would be an insertion of one word down in the definition of accounts, 32.11. And again, you can see that account, these exclusions are designed to make sure that companies that do legitimate and necessary work, validating transfers and validating work and making sure that employees get money put into the right accounts. We proposed adding in that line where it says accounts are defined as checking, savings, or money market account, including in that line investment. It's just, I believe it really was an oversight on that line, on the House language.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay. Anyone else here who wants to testify briefly, please? Just weighing in on the issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm from President of Citizens Council on Healthcare and have not been involved in the Social Security number issue during the session at all. But in sitting here and listening to it, I just have some questions I'd like to raise. And I'm not, you know, something for you to at least think about in your discussion. I looked at line 32.3 on R30 and where it talks about health. And the one thing that I'd like to raise with that question is I'm concerned that this could lead to anyone who goes to the – I realize it says health and it relates to plans, benefits, or investment products. But my concern, and that's why I raised the question, is could there be a time where you have to show your Social Security number to get access to health care? And I think that would be a very bad idea, and that shouldn't be allowed to happen. So – I raise the question to say, please consider that. Then on line 31.35, where it's a very broad, this thing of government purposes. It says law enforcement, and then it says government or public safety purposes. And that just seems incredibly broad to me. I don't know what any possible government purpose could be. And then Graham Leach Bliley, I know there are like, I don't know if it's 17 or 19 exceptions for exchange of health information. And so I don't know how that relates, and I'm just sitting here, and so I don't know what Title 15 is, but something for you to think about. And then the last thing has to do with the comment from Mr. Neumeister, which caused me to look at the sections of the law here that say government entity. And my concern is, and I haven't read it at all, is to just say it looks like here we've moved from statewide systems and agencies to government entity, which could be any government entity. I mean, I could be wrong about this, but could it be a city government, a local government, what could that all be, and what have we done here, and is that what you wanted to do, and is that good for the public? I don't know. So questions I raise.
Thank you. What I'd like to do now is, since we've heard testimony, I think, from stakeholders or other interested parties who want to speak on this, let me just make a couple quick comments to see if I am understanding where we are right now. If I could distill it, and Representative Hillstrom can correct me, or anyone can correct me if I'm wrong. What originally happened was Representative Hillstrom in the House and Senator Chaudhary in the Senate introduced a bill in the Attorney General's office, and the main thrust for the gist of the bill was to restrict the sale of the commercial sale of Social Security numbers. That, in a nutshell, was it. That's the aim, that's the goal. There was some discussion with some of the folks we've heard from today in the business community who weren't either for or against it, but it later became clear to them that they had a problem with current law, or the law that is set to take place on July 1st of this year. since Representative Hillstrom's bill at some point was essentially the only vehicle for them to do the fix that they needed, that's why we're here. In other words, the bankers and others who have testified in business interests are agnostic, I guess, on Representative Hillstrom's initial bill, but they, frankly, now need her bill because it's a vehicle for the fix that they want, which is current law, and their concern, right, wrong, or otherwise, is that on July 1st, if we don't do something, consequences will follow. So that, I think, is why we're here generally, and that is why Representative Hillstrom has been working with them. They need her, she needs them to some extent, and that's why we're here. So I see many hands going up, the first of which was Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I mean, to that point, when I was approached with it, I mean, given the dynamics of the change of majority in the House and that Deb was already working on a Social Security bill, it made sense to me that this issue be addressed in the context of a Social Security bill rather than me, a minority member, trying to scramble around, you know, introduce a separate little bill and swim upstream with it, you know, because it seemed to make sense to be worked on in the bigger picture.
Senator Lemmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I've been listening to this discussion, it kind of brings us back to where our balance should be. And whenever we talk of data privacy, we're always talking of balance. And balance perhaps in protecting the individual consumer's interest versus maybe in this case the cost to business of how we manage this information. And yet, as I look at it, and I can only think of some of the issues that kind of float around in headlines from time to time. In the last, let's say just the last year, I've seen numerous news clippings of CD-ROM disks or laptop computers that have been left on a subway or they've been stolen out of an office, and you've got not only thousands but millions of accounts that have millions of account numbers, maybe even Social Security numbers on them. TJ Maxx was the most recent one. Even government records that the state of Minnesota had promised to those of us on data privacy committee, saying that they would certainly assure the security of intimate data of its citizens, were found that they couldn't even do that. And then the legislative auditor got involved. So when we talk of making Social Security numbers perhaps a little bit more manageable for corporations through this legislation, I always have to ask the question, where is the balance that we're – what's the balance of the other stakeholders at stake? And we've had – a couple representatives from at least the private individual citizen groups representing just everyday citizens saying if we go too far in this or too broad, this certainly will open the door or cause an increased probability that Social Security numbers will be no better secure than all of the headlines we've seen in recent weeks and months. So we also have heard that other states have approached this issue and have done it in a different way. We don't know exactly what those other ways are. And I'm a little concerned of not having a wider perspective of how other states have tried to resolve this issue. And I think that's if one thing I have begun to hear, at least on the Senate side of this discussion, is that since we know of other states that have maybe cured this problem in a different way, and since we didn't have an aggressive presentation of this issue in the Senate, we're a little at a loss to where to go. This is a very complex issue. I've worked on data privacy issues for nearly 12 of the 19 years I've been in the legislature, and they're always complex. And yet, where do we find the balance between between all of the stakeholders and ultimately assure the privacy of its citizens.
Senator Betzold was next.
No, I...
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say that I really feel for Representative Hillstrom because I think her bill started out as a consumer bill that was designed to offer consumer protection, and I would feel a lot more comfortable if we were just adding some elements of consumer protection, and that was all we were talking about. What I don't feel comfortable with here is what it seems like we're doing is we had a history of some consumer protection, and the business community now has run into perhaps some concerns with that. And so we may be rolling back a lot of that protection way beyond the one particular issue that's being raised. And specifically, I have to go back again to what Mr. Neumeister said about businesses in general, way beyond the specific federal requirements for Social Security numbers. It appears we're giving all businesses an opportunity to require a Social Security number if they deem that it's necessary to the transaction. And I would think we'd want a lot of discussion of that before we'd make that kind of sweeping conclusion that, you know, whether that's normal in doing businesses. I just don't have enough knowledge about this issue, but I that strikes me as maybe going the opposite direction from where we were trying to go with this type of use. So I'm very uncomfortable about that, and I'm sympathetic to Representative Kilstrom, but it seems to me, if I can accurately recall the series of events here, this is something that the business community, banking community, has known about ever since this bill was first enacted, and yet this came to us with a request for an amendment at the very 11th hour when it was too late for us in the Senate side to have brought this through the committees, that it did go through on the House side with respect to something beyond the consumer protection issues that Representative Hillstrom started out with.
Representative Horton.
I just want to hear what Senator Betzold's proposed solution is.
Yes.
And just one housekeeping note, members, for the House members, my understanding is we have some more time. So we were going to go into 10.
We have
someone is going to check and come back, but I think we're okay in case you were looking at your watch wondering if we had to be up there. Go ahead, Senator.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, the thing that is driving everybody's attention right now is the fact that we have a law that is going to go into effect and the credit bureaus are going to shut down these credit reports. I think that's got everybody concerned. I recognize that Representative Hillstrom has spent a lot of time working on this. If the Senate author or authors didn't put that much time in, I don't know, I can't speak for any other senator, but I think it needs to be having a discussion. If you want to have the bill exactly what you've got jacketed and get it to me, I'll be happy to introduce it with whatever time we've got left. We can get it in by Monday, and I'll carry it to the Judiciary Committee, the Hated Data Practices Subcommittee, the Commerce Committee, the Business Committee, and all the one stops that it's going to have to make. If Senator Limmer wants to sign on, I'll be happy to bring him with me, but we'll do what we can. But in order to deal with the issue that we've got at hand, and I am somewhat familiar with this. I've had a hand in the legislation that's here. I don't agree with the interpretation, but if that's how the credit bureaus are doing it. We delayed the effective date for a reason. And the reason why was because we wanted to see if there's any unintended consequences. Apparently, there is an unintended consequence. And this law is going into effect on July 1st of 2007. So, if we delayed the effective date again to July 1st of 2008, the crisis doesn't go away, but it sure gives the legislature enough time to work out these kinks and issues, and that's an issue as we wish to do so, and it holds us to the deadline. And that's, I think that would sort of solve everything at the moment.
While Representative Hillstrom is pondering that, anyone else who has a specific comment to that? Okay. What I propose is this, and it doesn't look like we have any other testimony. What I propose is this. very intriguing. I, frankly, am deferring heavily to Representative Hellstrom for obvious reasons. What I'd like to do is move on to a couple of housekeeping or smaller, what should be non-controversial subjects, so that can sink in, and it may be after we're off the record, Representative Hellstrom and Senator Betzel can talk, and I think that could be part of a very fruitful end to this. Here's what I propose, members, is there are a couple of other, you might recall that Ms. Pontius yesterday walked us through some language conflicting that appeared in both bills that was conflicting and that was really utterly non-controversial. There are three more, at least by my count, that I saw as not quite to the level of non-controversial as those, but maybe just a tick higher. They involve a couple of quick policy judgments, but they really should be things that, in my judgment anyway, we could resolve very quickly. And I will start with, on the side-by-side, Section 27 of the House bill, which is
R11,
I believe. And we could just discuss it here, and I'll be honest, I don't personally have any strong preference, and others on the committee may, so we ought to get that on the open here. Yeah, Section 20, R12, pardon me, on R12. If you look on the House language, line 14.2, the House has used the term state government, and the Senate equivalent is just to say, well, is not to limit it to state government, but rather to all government that's covered under the Debtor Practices Act. I guess my own personal judgment would be that I like the Senate language better because it is more broad and it's in keeping with what we normally do with the Debtor Practices Act, but I just wanted to bring that to your attention. I wouldn't say it's non-controversial, but it's something I think we can resolve here pretty quickly. Any thoughts about that? Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, the language, it seems, it appears that the language was intentionally changed in the House language. I'd be interested to hear from the House members the rationale for that change to do the limiting language.
To do a what?
Limiting.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, in talking to counsel about this, and actually I remember more of that conversation than I do about whether we talked about this in committee, but basically what this had to do with is whether we're going to have, whether a public official in terms of the language here is going to include just state public officials like heads of departments and so forth, or whether that's also going to include local public officials, people on county boards or city officials, I should say. And it has to do with whether the data related to complaints or investigations are going to be made public. And so the question is whether we want to apply that same standard of releasing that kind of information to the public with respect to city and county or local officials, department heads, and so forth, or whether that should just be at the state level.
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I don't read that in the Senate language.
Within state. Could you speak to that? Mr. Chair, could we have Ms. Pontius
sure,
speak
absolutely.
To this?
Ms. Pontius.
The Senate bill does not add the phrase state government.
Right.
And right now I get this provision has been subject to a couple of conflicting interpretations as to whether or not it is limited to state government. And I believe the department can speak to that. But this was actually a recommendation from the department initially to at least clarify the statute one way or the other. I think there's one Court of Appeals decision versus an Eighth Circuit decision that reached opposite results.
Ms. Byer-Krupinski, do you want to weigh in on this on behalf of the department?
Mr. Chair and members, yes, we brought this forward. The change in the House language is meant to reflect the legislative history from 1995 and 96. When you read this language, you don't see that the intent really was just to apply to state government. and it was. So we have both a federal court judge who misread the language, and we have also issued advisory opinions to clarify that the intent was state government. Our only goal is that when normal people read the statute, they understand what it means and who it applies to. So if the legislative intent was to keep it only to state government, people should be able to understand that. If the legislature now would like to make a policy shift and have it apply more broadly, they could certainly do so. But we'd want to make sure that everyone understands what the language is meant to cover.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I have copies of the federal court case as well as the advisory opinion, if that is helpful, just to further explain the issue.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, I think with that explanation, I'd like to move the House language.
Before we go to your motion, Representative Cox.
Mr. Chairman, when I look at 1429, so we're looking at old language, and I see a state agency, statewide system, or political subdivision. Political subdivision certainly meant that the old language extended it beyond. You know, it seems to me that government entity is the appropriate substitution of the old language. If we go to the House language, I think you're limiting it to more than it used to be.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not familiar with the legislative history or the court history of this specific issue. But in terms of how this would apply and issues in my district, I can think of numerous local level issues that have come up involving department heads or local government officials where things happen that the public doesn't understand. And it seems to me that in many ways, in an individual county or city, the public is often more interested in those local issues than they are in the state level issues. And to the extent that when a person is working for a government entity, whether it be state level or local, that the public, I believe, has an interest in those issues and why decisions are made, I guess my personal policy belief is that we should make that information as available as possible.
Chair, Senator Olson, I agree that there is a policy debate to be had, but the only isolated issue we were trying to address here is to make the language match what the intent was. And if you want to have that broader policy discussion, it could certainly be done. But for the time being, I don't want people to continue to read this language and misunderstand what it means.
Again, just looking at 1320 to 1323, I don't understand how you think that state agency, statewide system, or political subdivision was meant to be only within state government. And further down, same thing, 1324 to 13.26.
Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, I guess maybe I need clarification if the within state government is only modifying lines 14.1 and 14.2. Or if it's modifying only section 27 of the bill, or if it's your intent that everywhere we change government entity within this bill to mean within state government.
Ms. Breyer-Kopensky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the 1343, which is the personnel data section, applies to all state government. This paragraph E from 1327 to 14.2 is the section, the definition of a public official is the only instance where it applies just to state government, or that was the intent when it was enacted.
And Madam Chair, again, or Mr. Chair, my question is the wording on 14.2 within state government intended to only modify that subdivision 3, the whole section 27 of the House language, or related to the definition of government entity across the board?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, it specifically amends the sub 14.1 and 14.2 because it's not necessary to amend 1 and 2 since that is specific to state agency heads, members of boards appointed by the governor, and other elected officials. But in concept, this paragraph 3 justifies to E, 13.27 to 14.2.
Okay.
And the remainder of this section and 1343 applies to all government entities that are all at that defined term.
Okay. So as I understand it, adopting the House language would freeze the status quo. We can revisit the policy later. You're just clarifying the status quo. It's not necessarily a policy judgment when we can revisit it. Okay. Senator Mua has moved that acceptance of the House language. All in favor, say aye.
Yep.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. House language is adopted. The next item that I wanted to take up, and again, Section 45 of the House bill, which is on page R18. We really just have a difference here in two phrases. The Senate uses the term on line 16.23 of the Senate side versus 20.7 of the House side. The House uses the language lists of stockholders. Senate uses shareholder financial data. Is there anyone here who can comment on the reason for the difference or a preference? Again, I'm personally neutral. It's a conflict.
Mr. Chair, this is a...
I'm sorry. Once again, we're on page R18 on line 20.7 on the House language. The term used is lists of stockholders. On line 16.23, directly across on the Senate language, the like term is shareholder financial data. Otherwise, the provision is similar. I don't know the import of the difference, and I'm totally open. I just want to.
Mr. Chair, this was my bill in the House, and I think that the Senate language provides greater protection for individuals' data, and I think that we'd be happy to take the Senate language on that provision.
So moved.
So moved.
And Mr. Chair, I think this is a MnDOT. They came and testified on this, and as we had some testimony from them, they weren't trying to protect lists of, and I think shareholders the better term, the stockholder.
Okay.
They weren't trying to protect the list. They were trying to protect the data about them, and so that's why we chose the language that we did. And shareholder was just a better term, I thought.
Okay. Representative Holberg has moved acceptance of the Senate language. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The Senate language is adopted. Okay. The next one that I can see, well, this isn't really so much a conflict. An issue that I think we ought to revisit, and I'd like to hear from Mr. Gehring of House Research, who discovered this issue. I think it's something that should be on our radar screen. If you look at, I think it's sections 58 and 62 of the House bill, which would be R25 and R27. That's what we're zeroing in on, and there's a lot of words there, but it really comes down to something fairly simple. I can let Mr. Gehring explain, but as I understand the upshot here, there was language slipped in here that basically transfers from the Department of Revenue to the counties responsibilities for processing certain types of tax refunds. And I should just tell you, members, I want to put it on the radar screen because I know the counties aren't happy about it. They didn't catch it. And I know that at least on the House side, our tax folks, Representative Marquardt, came to me and said that he didn't like this and that it's something that should be properly vetted in the tax committees in both chambers because it's basically dumping a responsibility from the state to the counties.
Whose bill is this?
That's my view from 30,000 feet. But Mr. Perry, if you could explain it.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Section 62, Section 52 of the House and Senate language on page R27 are identical with one exception, with a cross-reference exception. Basically, this section establishes a new subdivision that starting in 2008 and thereafter, when people want to apply for Class 1B Homestead Declaration, which is a classification based on if you're blind or have a disability, you get certain property tax benefits for that. I'm not going to claim to be a tax expert, but the difference here is that currently you file these declarations with the Department of Revenue. In 2008, you file a declaration with the county assessor. So that's the substantive piece of this. There's also on page R25, which is House Section 58 and Senate Section 48, there's a distinction in that the Senate language specifies that a Minnesota tax law is defined as only the first part of that homestead declaration language. So only the language that applies to sending your declaration to the Commissioner of Revenue. My understanding is that this language was not agreed to by the House Tax Committee.
Senator Mouma.
Mr. Chair, first of all, let me put it on the record that this was not an attempt to slip something into a bill. So let me put that up front. In the Senate, we have a historically and under current practice, we believe very strongly that data, anything having to do with data, whether it's a tax provision or in any other committee, really ought to come to the Data Practice Committee. And what we've done is that where it was appropriate, we've actually taken the data practice provision of that bill and park it in the Data Practices Subcommittee and let the rest of the bill go. Because we couldn't break it apart, what we did do was we kept the data practices piece of it, but we also sent it on its own back to the Tax Committee. It is a provision that's currently in the Senate, I think on the Senate side, in the Senate Omnibus Tax Bill that's currently being negotiated in the Tax Conference Committee. I don't think that if this is an issue for this committee in terms of addressing this, it is a data provision that we ought to look at, but it's not anything that we have to fight about in this conference committee. We could just not address this issue and let the tax committee deal with that. I think that's the most respectful way to do it, but I just want to let you all know that that's our practice in the Senate, and it's not an attempt to slip anything.
Senator Mouma, I should have been more clear about that. I was talking about what went on in the House side. Yeah. It was a more substantive debate. It should have been on the House side a more substantive debate, and what I would say is to resolve it the way that you've explained, which sounds like the most sensible way, we should do absolutely nothing. We're working off of the Senate file. You shouldn't adopt the House language. You shouldn't touch it. And, in fact, your Section 34 on page R16 is the only place where we've done anything here, and it is in the responsible manner that you said, just touching the data piece. But I wanted to address it here and bring it out into the open so we know what was in there. So go ahead.
On page R16, Section 34, it's a similar cross-reference to Section 2. So if you're not going to address the issue and on page R27, I think you don't want to do Section 34 either.
Right. I'm not sure I follow. Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chair, the Senate Section 34 on page R16 is a cross-reference to the new language that's established on page R27 because they're creating a new subdivision 2. So if the committee is agreeing to not address the substantive policy on page R27, then the appropriate language should not also not be discussed would be the Senate Section 34 on page R16 and also page R25, Section 48.
Okay. So to effectuate what Senator Mouma is saying, is what?
Never move.
Okay. Great. All right. Members, the next thing that I wanted... it's there. It's in the Senate. We're working off of the Senate file, so... Is there anything we...
To leave it to the tax committee. So we won't move it.
No, we move nothing.
Nothing.
So, Mr. Chair,
you like to stab the stake in the heart.
Representative Khan, happy, we'd be glad.
The appropriate procedural piece is that the conference committee report doesn't have any language until the committee adopts it. So if you don't adopt the language, it's not going to go in.
But if you want to rub it in.
My other comment is on page R25, this section 58 and 48 difference, there is a different substantive piece in addition to the subdivision 1 property tax language that the committee may want to address, which is adding chapter 297B into the list of Minnesota tax laws. This is unrelated to the property tax thing. Chapter 297B deals with motor vehicle taxes, registration taxes. So
this is Senate Section 48 on page R25.
Right. To avoid the discussion we just had, the committee may want to either adopt the House language so that you have the Chapter 297B reference, or if you didn't want to add that reference, then you would just do nothing.
But don't we have 297B in both?
Yes. Yes, Mr. Chair, we have 297B.
Right. Yeah. So I'm just I'm so for
motor vehicles. It
refers to subdivision one.
On both sides. Both this House and Senate do have the 297B reference. What I'm saying is that the House has the 297B reference without the additional subdivision 1 at the bottom, which is the problem with the property tax issue. So if you want to address this issue, the committee would probably want to adopt the House language because
I so moved, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Well, I wanted to make that motion.
Senator Metzen.
I want to prove that I've been here the last
Senator Metzen moves.
Thank you, adoption, Representative Simon.
The House language, which would be Section 58. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The House language is adopted. Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, and members, I have to compliment Senator Metzen. It takes a tremendous amount of courage. You know, we are the only 4 willing members of the Senate Data Practices Subcommittee, and when we needed an extra conferee, Senator Metzen offered himself. That's a tremendous amount of courage and great depth of intellectual curiosity.
This is really good.
And we'd like to know what you paid him.
Welcome to the cult.
Members, there are just a couple more things, I think, that we, in my judgment, at least discuss, if not move something. Two differences that I saw that I think we could have a quick discussion on. One is Section 51 of the House bill, which I believe is on page R20, Section 51. Basically, what this says, and I can give you the background, members, this was a bill by Representative Mullery, and I will let you know, and this is one of those process issues, where there's an intellectual argument on the other side to be had that I totally understand. There was no Senate file. None. This was a House file with no Senate companion that made its way through the process. It was
who's the House author again, Mr. Chair?
It was Representative Mueller.
Representative
Mueller did not have a Senate file. And this would give parole and county probation authorities access to data on the purchase or transfer of firearms. That's it. My understanding is, I can't be here to talk for him, but my understanding is that there was some agreement with some of the gun owner advocates who attended the hearing, and there was something worked out, but I will concede there was no Senate file. So I don't know what folks want to do about this or not. I just throw it out there because it's something in the House bill, not in the Senate. Senator Olson.
As I think I told you before,
there is a difference.
Major difference.
My own children will tell you that I'm known in our family for confusing names, and I've done this in other committees a couple times this year, so I apologize. But as you know, we talked about this. And when it comes to things that impact gun rights, people in my district are very sensitive to that issue. And I don't deny that or doubt that Representative Mullery had those conversations, but I would feel much more comfortable with the opportunity to have heard them in committee ourselves and to have those conversations on the record.
Representative Holder.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and Joel Olson from the Gun Rights Group. This was, as the bill was introduced, there was a gazillion emails and the feathers flying everywhere, and over a couple days' work, this language was approved by the gun rights folks. But from my perspective, if there's major heartburn, I understand, around the gun issue. And
Senator Lemon.
thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern, since I haven't talked to Mr. Olson, is why a parole or probation authority would need to look into the background of a defendant who hasn't been convicted of a crime yet, and that just triggers the whole criminal justice perspective on this issue. I could see a parolee or a probationer, but a defendant, I would like to know more information on it. And not having it, I'm a little hesitant to go forward on it.
Yeah, members, what I'm hearing is that this is a bigger thing than we really have time for here, and we focused our energy on a couple flashpoints. I don't think we need any more major flashpoints. So I don't think we need to do anything here on this. We don't need to do anything. It's presumptively not in. The last thing that I have on my list, members, these are non-flashpoint issues, and this is something that I understand is a necessary fix, a departmental fix, and I think Representative Hillstrom could explain. This is Section 57 of the House language. I think Representative Hillstrom was involved in this, and I think it is just a fix.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, myself, Senator Olson, and Senator Moore were all on the public safety omnibus bill. And when we closed up that bill in conference, I thought there might be a problem with the unemployment data that we granted the Department of Corrections access to the unemployment data. And I noticed it as we closed up the bill, and I sent staff to talk to Representative Holberg, and she agreed with me. We gave them access to all unemployment data, not just that of former prisoners. And so this tightens it up and says they have access to unemployment data only of people who have previously been in their custody. And that's it.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, and I've talked to counsel about this, and she assures me that this is a needed change to correct something that we passed to make it clear. So I'd like to move to accept the House language on this.
Okay, we're caving again.
You got on record again.
Does someone care to move the adoption of the House language?
She did.
Oh, you just did. I'm sorry. Someone was whispering in my ear.
No, you can do it. Senator Olson.
You did it so well before.
Did I? I'll so move. The House language. Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Olson moved the House language. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? House language is adopted.
That's enough.
Members, from my perspective, and I'd love to entertain other roadmap ideas. From my perspective, what we have done between yesterday and today is we have adopted the same as similars. We've just gone through all the things on my list where there was a difference of language, where it was not exactly non-controversial, but very, very low controversy level.
66 and 68.
We have focused our efforts, at least in terms of testimony, on a couple of what I would call the flashpoint issues, which is newborn screening and Social Security. My own inclination is not to entertain any motions at this time on those issues or outstanding issues, because I think there's some more discussion to be had offline here. So from my own perspective, I think we can recess right now until later, when folks can discuss the flashpoint issues and what we're going to do, and then we can come back at some point, hopefully today, depending on the two bodies' schedules, and we can entertain motions one way or another on what I call the flashpoint issues. Anyone else have any kind of comments as to the roadmap? First, Representative Holberg, then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The Health Department was kind enough to provide each of the committee members with a copy of their two materials, and I would ask that each of the senators take this brochure and read it and see if they catch where the rights and of parents are delineated in this brochure. In addition, we provided for you a copy of the ALJ ruling, and if you want to start basically on page 21 to 27, 28, that's kind of the meat of the matter relative to the judge's ruling, what the ramifications are in the current program, and we'll certainly have more discussion once the Senate gets up to speed on these issues.
Mr. Chair, just for the member or the audience here today, the one thing you didn't touch on is things that were perhaps in the House bill that by inference, the idea that we're probably not going to pick those things up is the decision that we kind of unanimously made. And so if there's something that you don't, that you're concerned, people in the audience are concerned about that they didn't hear discussed, we should maybe give an opportunity if anyone wants to address them.
That's the point, General. Yes, I think that inference is correct. There are some things in the House bill that were not in the Senate bill that we have agreed in the interest of time and and other things just not to take up, which means they are they will not be in the bill by default because nothing will happen on them. For example, I'll just throw one big one out there, which could have been a flashpoint, the issue of fees or increased fees or penalties on institutions who violate the Debtor Practices Act. There's a provision in the House, there's a couple provisions upping the penalties and so forth, and we've decided not to even take that up, which means they won't be in the bill. So if there's anyone here on an issue like that who wanted to comment one way or another, certainly feel free to do so at this time, or on any other issue. Again, we'll be coming back, but I think we've resolved first the similars yesterday, then what Senator Olson correctly characterized as really sort of non-controversial stuff. Then I think we discussed a couple of took testimony on a couple of the flashpoint issues, Social Security and newborn screening, and then we went through things that weren't exactly non-controversial, I guess mild controversy to them, but I think we've resolved all of those. Representative Holberg, and then I would invite anyone else with any final words before we recess and come back later to entertain motions on remaining issues.
Mr. Chair, I may have missed it, but was any action or discussion taken on the Met Council Labor Relations Data, Sections 1066 and 68 in the House language?
President Holberg, no, and that's because that was included among the things that we decided that we just probably weren't going to get to this year.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I missed that piece. I didn't know that that had hit the cutting room floor yet.
Although on that particular one, and I had the bill and it came to me quite late, but it's my understanding that admin is giving a temporary classification on that. So the urgency, I think, on that one is that we don't have to do anything right now. That is right for next year, and I've got the bill, and we can probably have some discussion on it. But it came late to get it in to do anything on this year. So.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, there is one thing that council and also a note has pointed out to me where we went through and looked at differences in styles, differences, their language differences. I think there was one we missed yesterday.
I think you're right.
And that was section 49 on the House side and 42 on the Senate side.
You're right, Senator Olson, and Mr. Gehring just told me the same thing. Do you want to speak to that?
I guess I would only say that we did have some discussion regarding this language, and because we felt that stylistically the language needed some clarification, I don't know, just looking at this quickly, if there are really any substantive changes. I think it was a change for purposes of clarification.
Senator Olson, my understanding, just looking at it, is that on the House side, on line 21.24, the language used is when an innocent party's name is associated. And on the Senate side, almost directly across at line 18.7, it says if an individual's name. And again, I'm frankly neutral, so if members have...
Now I recall this better. We read the language that was introduced initially several times, and we had difficult time cracking it. Even as attorneys, it was hard for us to clearly understand what was being referred to. And so we worked with the department to change that language that we thought made it more clear. So there was no intention to make any substantive change here. It was just for purposes of what we felt was making the language clear.
Okay. Anyone else have a comment on which version might be better here? Representative Holder.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and we had some discussion of the bill as introduced as well and made changes to it. And one of the points that the House was concerned about is that to make sure that in no instance would an individual be compelled to give a fingerprint, that would be completely voluntary. To provide the fingerprint. So I just want to make sure that the Senate language would preserve that there's no intent by the Senate to compel a fingerprint for these purposes.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Holberg, for putting that on the record. I don't think there's anything about the Senate language that would change that. It looks as though the House language is just the language as was initially introduced by the department. Was there some change in your language? Because I'm not seeing that.
President Holberg, you want to speak to that?
Mr. Chair, the language as introduced was not clear that it was voluntary, and there was some discussion with the author, and before we came back to actually putting the omnibus bill together, there were some changes to the language.
Are you satisfied with what's been said on the record here? Would you be willing to accept the Senate language, or do you have reservations?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to move the Senate language. I just want the record to show that it's not the intent of a legislature that an innocent party at any point has to give a fingerprint to prove that.
Representative Holberg has moved acceptance of the Senate language. That would be the Senate language in section 42 on page R20. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The Senate language is adopted. Is there anything else, and I include staff in this question, anything else that
we
haven't covered
we use
other
the term
than
main.
The issues that are off the table? Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, perhaps on our bottom of R15, this looks technical. I don't think we've done it. In the top of R16, these look very technical, and I don't think we've addressed those.
Section 32.
Yeah, it'd be Senate Section 32, House Section 37, and then, yes. And then it goes on to Section 39 of the House, but it's Subdivision 3 of the Senate, so.
Senator Betzel, my understanding is that this is one of many times throughout this that we simply made the change government entity for the longer, clunkier term, and this was more or less a housekeeping term to string on the language, so I believe that's correct.
Mr. Chair, members, the difference here is that the House version separated out three subdivisions, and the Senate version just incorporated them all into one section, but the changes are just technical.
Mr. Chair,
it all goes into law.
Does the term government entity, is that directly synonymous with the previous term? Are we agreeing to that?
Senator Lindbergh, that's my understanding. I'm looking at the Department of Administration folks, and they vigorously say yes. I think it's just a more streamlined term for the same thing, that there's no substantive change. That was at least our assumption all along. Mr. Garrett.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll take a look. The definition of government entity in the Data Practices Act is state agency, political subdivision, statewide system.
I have no preference whatsoever. I'd entertain a motion to adopt one or the other. I don't think
Mr. Chair, I think it all goes into the statute books the same. I'll move the House language.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, I thought we already did
it,
but I don't think it hurts to
make
that
point. I don't know what marks.
Did we already
talk? We did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I did not mark it then.
That's why I was watching
you. Is there anything else that needs to be...
And if you start at page 21...
There's a repealer on the back. We both are repealing Section 13.79, Subdivision 2. I don't remember what that does. I don't recall if there's a dress I am.
Is this on page R31?
This is that with the same.
Yeah.
Page R31.
Yeah, R31. I don't know if we, I had not marked it up. If we did it, I didn't mark it. I just have to run down
the
check.
Did we do
this?
I think we did
this on Okay. Okay.
Chair and members, this repealer goes with the restructuring of the labor and industry data and mediation services data. So, there's some new language that was just replaced, and this repealer goes along with that. And the language is identical between the two bodies.
Okay. Is there anything else? And again, just to clarify, I think we've done all the hashing out for now. I think on a couple of the flashpoint issues, there needs to be a little more discussion before we come back, hopefully sometime today, and reconcile it. Hopefully one
that
more.
That was one of the problems.
Any other comments by the public or Mr. Sparks? Okay, with that, we'll stand in recess to the call of the chair. I'm not sure where that is at this point, unfortunately.
Like I never get my social security.
We're in recess.
Like I...
Can we leave?